Hi, I'm Rick Sanchez. I've been doing news for 30 years in two languages around the world and here in the United States. Interviewed four presidents, worked at four of the U.S.'s major television networks. I believe news should be honest, direct, and impactful. This is Direct Impact. You know, countries around the world have been asking a certain question about the United States dollar now for the better part of the last decade. At first hint, it was maybe more of just that, a hint, or maybe even a whisper, so as to not get shut out or shut down by Washington or U.S. banks. But now, the question is being asked more boldly, it seems, and with more conviction. Here's Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva saying it out loud and for all the world to hear. And doing so from China, no less.
Eu toda noite me pergunto por que que todos os países estão obrigados a fazer seu comércio lastreado no dólar. Por que que nós não podemos fazer o nosso comércio lastreado na nossa moeda?
Lula da Silva, or Lula, as he's known throughout the hemisphere, was meeting at the time with Chinese President Xi Jinping. Xi and Lula are taking the very first steps to be able to trade in their own currencies somehow, while trying to diminish or cut out exchange in dollars altogether. The leaders say that the reason that they're doing this is because it's a cost-cutting move. But you know what? It's likely much more than that. In fact, it's a political statement seemingly meant to send a message to the West, and more specifically to Washington, that it may be time for a change and get used to it. See, this latest de-dollarization move is led by BRICS. It's an organization of countries talking about pulling together an agreement to serve, in essence, as its own bank to work around the U.S. dollar. BRICS is a coalition that includes Brazil and Russia and India and China and South Africa, and who set their agenda at an annual summit each year. It isn't just Brazil and Beijing, though, that's talking about all this de-dollarization thing. Suddenly, from India to Argentina, Brazil to South Africa, from the Middle East to Southeast Asia, nations and regions are accelerating efforts to reduce their dependence on the dollar. So how did we get here? Let's start with Iran. The decision by the Trump administration to renege on the Iran nuke deal and to actually amplify its sanctions in spite of an international agreement with Tehran demonstrated that the U.S. is willing to push its will, our country, despite what other countries might want or think, and that we're also willing to use what amounts to economic warfare. But now the U.S. has doubled down. And this time, the Biden administration, with a series of financial sanctions against Moscow, the likes of which are bound to have repercussions. First, there was the decision to freeze $300 billion, which is nearly half of Russia's foreign currency reserves. And if that wasn't economically punitive enough, the U.S. then moved to remove Russian banks from SWIFT, an interbank messaging service, which is how countries essentially talk with banks and are able to communicate with one another. Taken together with the most recent economic restrictions imposed on Venezuelan firms and Chinese firms, there is this message that countries around the world are hearing loud and clear. The U.S. is willing to deploy what appears to be economic warfare, but more importantly, that it's willing to use its now perhaps more than they've ever have in the past. So it's not just about doing it, it's about doing more of it. And that may be why countries from Latin America to Africa to the Middle East are asking themselves, look, if they can do it to those countries, if they can do it to China and Russia and Venezuela and Iran, will we be next? And is it time to start looking for an alternative? Joining us now to talk about this is economist and professor Richard Wolff. Always good to see you, my friend. I'm glad we get a chance to talk about this. What do you make of this situation with Lula da Silva going out there and just saying out loud what a lot of countries have been thinking, and how important is that?
Very important. And what he's saying is in the minds and in the press releases of more and more countries every day. There is no nice way around this. The U.S. dollar became the global currency at the end of World War II because the United States was the only country to come out of that war stronger than it went in. And all its competitors were really prostrate, you know, unable to function. Mm-hmm. And the dollar became the international currency the way the British pound had been in the 19th century. And that couldn't last. Anybody who knows anything about history knows that that was a kind of exceptional situation and it would not last. But it brought enormous benefits to the United States. Very simple to explain. We bring goods and services from around the world here, French wine, Japanese cars, whatever it is, and we give them in exchange little green pieces of paper that cost nothing to make. If they need dollars, they accept those pieces of paper. We get the benefit of real product, and they get paper. And then to make it worse, since the paper doesn't give them anything, no interest, they lend the paper back to the American government, helping to fund the deficits, and they get an interest from the United States for holding those dollars. This is a wonderful benefit multiplied to the United States, but it makes every other country jealous. They want that. They don't want to be on the wrong end of that kind of deal. They want it in. For most of the 20th century, they couldn't. They weren't strong enough, and the United States was dominant. But with the new millennium, with the sanctions against Iran, for example, you're quite right, this began to break down. Countries wanted a little of the benefit for themselves. They didn't want to always have the dollar be the intermediary. Hmm. One of the biggest things that made that happen was Saudi Arabia, which agreed to be paid for its oil as the biggest oil producer in the world only in dollars, thereby making everybody need to hold dollars, to keep dollars in reserve, etc. When all of this changed, is in the new century, the last 20 years, because not only did countries become big enough and rich enough, led by China, to begin to say, seriously, we want our own currency to be part of the deal. Even Europe got the euro into there a little bit after the year 2000. But what really did it, and you were right, quite right, Rick, to point to this, when the United States changed its policies from being the dominant country in the world, making sure that its currency was everywhere available, it suddenly weaponized that dollar, weaponized the SWIFT system and all the other systems that use the dollar, used them for its own foreign policy objectives. At that point, you're not managing it for everybody. You're managing it for yourself.
That's a great, that's an amazing, you see, Shakespeare had a quote, right? You can't leave well enough alone. The United States was at a pretty, to use an old term that only guys like you remember, a pretty groovy place, right? I mean, they had the best of both worlds. But when we started doing what we've done with Citgo in Venezuela, just as an example off the top of my head, or with the deal with Iran, or what we're doing now with China, and my God, with, as you mentioned, what we did recently with Russia, that seems punitive. It's not we want to be a part of this system and we're going to be equal players. No. It's what you just said. We're in a position where we can use our power to leverage it against you. And I think that's the turnaround in this whole thing, Professor.
Yep. And I think if I can venture a moment of history, it's a classic moment when an empire makes a fundamental mistake. We've had a ride up in the American Empire. We replaced the British Empire. It was a good ride up. Took most of the second half of the 20th century and really roared forward. But it has peaked. We don't have the position we had before. We just don't. And the question is, how are you going to manage that? If you manage it by leveraging your power, beating up on other countries, you're going to sooner or later drive them to get together to confront you, the powerhouse, with the reality that you're not as strong as you once were, and they are stronger than they once were. That has to be accommodated, and warfare is not the way to do it. Not only not military warfare, which would be crazy now, but even economic warfare. The fact of the matter is, over the last 10 years, the dollar has gotten weaker literally every month. Hmm. It used to be that 70, 80% of the reserves in every central bank in this planet were in the form of dollars. Today, it's less than 45%. It's a catastrophic drop in the importance of the dollar and in the power of the United States to use that dollar. It's one of those examples where using that power was a big, big mistake and undercuts that power. It would have been much better in retrospect to have managed and kept your dominant position as a reliable, trustworthy manager than to become a partisan fighter when the rest of the world, and let's remember, the United States is very wealthy, but it's 4.5% of the world's population, not the rest of it. And the rest of it, let's remember, the two biggest countries in the world are India and China. They're part of the BRICS, as you correctly pointed out. This is the United States flailing around because it doesn't want to face that it's shrinking in its footprint around the world. Hmm. So is its empire. And whether you come to terms with that is the crucial question. And denial is not a solution.
You know, I've been talking to some economists in Latin America, and they've pointed out to me, they say, you know, Rick, I understand your point about the de-dollarization, but it's not so much about de-dollarization. It's just the fact of the matter that the world has changed. And while the United States was the Mac Daddy, as we like to say, economy in the world, today they're either not or about to be not because of what's going on with China. And that's really what is driving this. As you just mentioned, the economies of places like China and India and others. They're just, the world is changing.
The world is changing. And, you know, I get frightened, to be honest with you, Rick. I get frightened because either you arrange to manage that, live and let live. China has to have its way to develop its economy. We have to have our way. That can be worked out. I want to remind people a little bit of history. When the United States broke away in a violent revolution from another empire, the British Empire tried to stop it militarily. Right. We had the War of Independence, and then we had another war in 1812. And then the British realized they're not going to stop this by military means. And they came to terms with the United States, and we had a century of no war between those two countries. I think we need to learn that we're not going to punish China back. Trump couldn't do it. Biden can't do it. I'll give you one statistic because I'm an economist. We now have the results of economic growth the first 3 months of this year, January, February, March, first quarter of 2023. The economics of Britain, it grew zero, no growth at all. France, 0.2%. The United States, 1%. The People's Republic of China, 4.5%. I mean, you cannot make believe these realities aren't there. They've been there for 20 years. They're not going away. It's time to sit down and work out something where we can live together on this planet, because there really is no viable alternative. And the de-dollarization is a screaming message to us that I hope we have the brains and the capability to absorb.
I wonder if we do, though, because what I've seen lately from both the Trump administration and, frankly, going back to all the administrations, including the one that we have now, who happens to be a man with, you know, with all due respect to him and God bless his soul, is a guy from the Cold War mentality times of the 1950s and 60s, which makes him act like everything is about a bludgeoning tool. You just got to have the old American axe, and we can do away with all of our competitors. Well, no, we can't. But it seems like that's the only way that they're going. Do you see any way forward where we would be a little more understanding, a little maybe more compromising?
Well, I'm hoping, and I know this may sound a bit odd, I'm hoping that in a way defeat teaches us something, as it has in history, at least sometimes. Mm-hmm. We thought we had the power to win in Vietnam. We didn't. We thought we had the power to win in Afghanistan. We didn't. We thought we had it in Iraq. Yeah. We didn't. The reason we're talking now about F-16s in Ukraine is because of all the previous escalations did not work. That's why we keep giving them bigger and bigger bang for the buck. They're not winning that war. Russia hasn't been dropped to its knees. Russia found other people to buy its oil and gas, found other people to work their trade deals with. I'm not in favor of the regime or against the regime, but yeah. I want to look honestly. We're not able to do what we tried to do in the past. We had that power once, but we don't anymore. And the sooner we understand it, the sooner I think the capability is there to work out. Let's remember, Nixon and Kissinger went to China to, quote, open it up, and we had several decades in which the United States prospered and China prospered. I don't believe that is forever gone. I think that logic can come back. Neither of us wants a nuclear war, which is lunacy. So let's try to work out some arrangement that does not involve these efforts to destroy that are having negative effects. I mean, the irony is the inflation in Europe is worse than it is in yeah. Russia. Inflation in Europe is worse than it is here. They're paying an enormous price. The whole country of France has basically come to a stop because they can't work out the problems that come in large part from the rising price of energy, which makes Europe unable to compete with the rest of the world. I mean, the fallout from this should be teaching a lesson. You didn't understand yeah. what you were getting into, and it is blowing back on you in a way you have to take account of.
When we come back, I want to talk to you about Africa, Latin America, parts of the Middle East, the places that we haven't paid a lot of attention to in the past that are suddenly raising themselves up and saying, wait, yep. we want a piece of this too, by the way. Professor Richard Wolff, you stay right there. By the way, I have to tell you, I have a podcast where I, as a journalist, as a Latino, and as an entrepreneur, tell my story and share with you what I have learned. And we also talk about some of these stories that you hear right here. It's called the Rick Sanchez Podcast. I invite you to check it out when we come back. Well, more on the potential destruction of the U.S. dollars if many countries around the world, including some of the smaller ones, now say they can have it their way. We'll be right back.
Это деструктивно направленная личность. В его мыслях о созидании ничего не было. В его мыслях было только разрушение.
Культ Бандеры существовал вообще во всем мировом украинстве в послевоенное время. Он постепенно утверждался. Запад это поддерживал, потому что это Западу выгодно.
Лозунг националистов-бандеровцев был такой. Ни кацапа, ни жида, ни ляха. То есть, другими словами, должны были быть убиты все.
Украина должна была стать нацистской для того, чтобы соответствовать идеологии Североатлантического альянса.
Hey Hey, welcome back. I'm Rick Sanchez. I want to once again list for you some of the agreements that are already taking place that show that this de-dollarization effort is more than just a thought, and that our country's economic and foreign policy advisors would be smart to start taking some of these things into account. Argentina and Brazil recently moved forward on an agreement to facilitate trade between them, between each country, without having to use dollars. Back in March, as we reported here, a trade deal for a supply of natural gas was reached between the United States, the United Arab Emirates and China. And it was carried out in Chinese currency with the coordination of the French energy firm. Think about that. And then in April, reports surfaced that a group of countries were negotiating with India's central bank about conducting transactions in Indian rupees. Among the countries involved in those talks are the Maldives, Myanmar, Russia, and also, somewhat surprisingly, you ready for this? The United Kingdom, Germany, and New Zealand. So these are not little countries, but they're going along now with other countries that wouldn't traditionally be making these arguments. Back now with Professor Richard Wolff. What do you make of that, Professor, that not only are we seeing suddenly African nations, Latin American countries, like we said with Lula and Argentina, coming forward and asking for a change in the system, but that we're also seeing countries like New Zealand and even Great Britain popping their heads out and going, you know what? I think we want to be invited to this dance before it gets away from us. It seems to be what's going on, no?
Absolutely. I mean, in the past, by past I mean the last 50, 60, 70 years, any small country in Asia, Africa, Latin America, Eastern Europe, and so on, basically had nowhere to go. The dominant place to go for a loan, for a development project, for any idea about changing the system would be to go to Washington and Western Europe, maybe to Tokyo, and try to work a deal. But since the Japanese and the Western Europeans and the Americans were a tightly knit group that had worked together for a long time, you basically could not negotiate. You just could. Now you can. That is an earth-shaking difference, led by China, but now with the BRICS and all the people joining them, they are an alternative. So, for example, if you want to build a new railroad in some corner of Africa that can move key resources to the coast where they can be shipped around the world, who's going to build your railroad? It used to be either the United States or Western Europe. No, not the Chinese will come in, build you a better railroad, cheaper, quicker. What are you going to do? And if the Chinese can't, they will work a deal. And pretty soon, you're going to see the parts of the Western alliance, like you pointed out, breaking away, a French firm here, a British firm there, or maybe it looks like an Egyptian firm, but if you study it long enough, right behind it is a Belgian and a Dutch firm. In other words, they don't want to be left out. China is the most rapidly growing market in the world. I've taught in American business schools. We teach young entrepreneurs, you want to succeed? Be where the market is growing fastest. Mm-hmm. That's where you need to focus. Well, then you're going to go to China. And if your government says they're not nice in China, you're going to say, well, maybe, but if I'm going to survive competitively, I have to go there. Otherwise, I'm going to be left behind. This is a whole new world, and every small country is experiencing, whether we know it or not, intense debates inside the leaderships of those countries. Have we bet on the wrong horse by staying with the United States and Western Europe? Are we missing opportunities that would be better for the development of our society and for the profitability of our companies if we stay the way we've done? And they're answering the question. That's why de-dollarization is happening. The Chinese say, we're not going to deal in dollars. You have to deal in yuan. We'll deal in your currency. In other words, they're the up-and-comer. They are doing in the world what the United States 100 years ago was doing too, which is how it became what it was and why others are now saying it's our turn.
Well, I'll disagree with you on that just a little bit, and here's how I'll push back, because I happen to be Latin American, as you know, and I know all the stories my father and my uncles told me growing up as a kid. What the United States did in Latin America is maybe not the same as what China is doing in places like Africa and Latin America. The United States seemed to go in there with a clenched fist most of the time. And they did deals that required that country to be indebted to the United States forever and ever. And we only put in our workers and our companies to execute on whatever plan that we put in. And then we used U.S. Marines to back up those companies if those guys decided they wanted a more square deal, for lack of a better term. Isn't China doing it a little differently?
Yes, China is trying to do it a little differently. It's a little early to tell because the Chinese move here is really only a few years old in most of these parts of the world. So a little bit I have to hedge because we don't have quite enough information.
Fair.
But the logic of your point is valid. The Chinese know there's an accumulated 200 to 300 year bitterness and anger about the injustices of colonialism, both the full colonialism that the Europeans, for example, did in Africa, literally carving the country up, or the little bit more informal Monroe Doctrine type of control that the United States operated in Latin America. But the Chinese know they're on report. If they look or smell or talk like they're doing what was done before, they will get a blowback from the local people that will make it much harder for them to function. So they're under a kind of pressure to behave differently. And, you know, that's true for a company that goes into those parts of the world now. You cannot count on the American Marines to show up next week to force people to do what you want in the way you once could. That's no longer possible, not just for the Chinese, not possible for the West either. And if they don't learn that lesson, the departure of Asia, Africa, and Latin America to join BRICS, which is already underway, will accelerate.
Professor Richard Wolff, as usual, thank you for taking us through this. Thank you for your time, and I look forward to talking to you once again, my friend.
Same here, and I look forward to it just as much.
Thank you so much. Hey, before we go, I want to remind you of our mission, why we do this, right? And it's really simple. I think it's time to de-silo the world. We've got to stop living in these little boxes, right? Because truth, they don't live in boxes. Truth is everywhere. I'm Rick Sanchez. I'll be looking for you again right here, where I hope to provide a direct impact.